Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Welcome, everybody, to Nightlight. Thank you so very much for sharing your time with us. We understand how precious a commodity that is these days, and we really appreciate your joining us and listening to us and sharing with the wisdom that our guests can so frequently impart upon us. I want to thank first Ken Quiet Hawk for his amazing intro. You can find him at nativestorytellers.com. He and his wife have an amazing website, and they're a wonderful example of what Native storytelling is and has been for centuries, and how they have preserved their cosmology and their history and their legends through storytelling, and not used the textbooks that we have so often relied upon and have not been as fulfilling as one would hope. I'm really excited. I have Mary Joyce back with me tonight. And she has worked for two major metropolitan area newspapers as a feature editor, Sunday magazine editor, columnist, and artist. On the side, she's written magazine articles and books, and currently she is the editor of Skyships Over Cashiers website, which features a variety of cutting-edge topics. And I highly encourage you to check it out, not right now, but after the show, because you will be amazed at the variety that she touches on and the amazing way in which she presents her topics. Her career includes working for a Fortune 100 company, coordinating art and printing for Talking Children's Books. In that capacity, she worked directly with many creative teams, including those at Marvel Comics, Golden Books, Mr. Rogers, Bernstein Bears, and Steven Spielberg's E.T. book staff. Early in her career, she held promotional positions with the world's largest private printing company, an air pollution control agency, political campaigns, and a community college. And in her spare time, she has written a lot of books, and I imagine there are a lot more yet to come from her. But the ones that are currently out there that I know about are Underground Military Bases, Hidden in North Carolina Mountains, Cherokee Little People Were Real, Tangible Evidence of Jesus Left Behind for Us to Find, and her latest book, Bigfoot Beyond the Footprints. If you check out her website, and that's Skyships Over Cashiers, you'll find that every time she has an area of interest, she spins it into an article and possibly ultimately into a book. She is probably one of the most creative and manifestational people I have ever met, and I am so thrilled that she is with us tonight. Welcome, Mary. I'm glad you're back again.
Thank you. It's always good to talk to you.
Oh, you always bring a wealth of information, and you send me into research every time, so it's a true joy to have you here. we were going to talk about some of the things that you had on your website, and then you suggested that we look into Joseph of Arimathea. And it's really fascinating because I have recently, in some of the books that I've read for the interviews that I've been doing, his name keeps coming up. And it's a name that most people recognize for the crucifixion, of course. And yet there's so much more to his story, and I feel that, you know, it's coming out in dribs and drabs all over the place. And you mentioned that, you know, it would be interesting to talk about him at this particular time of the year.
Absolutely. And, you know, everybody just knows about this rich man named Joseph of Arimathea, who gave his tomb for Jesus after the crucifixion. That's about all you see in the Bible, and that's about all anybody might know about the man. And yet he was actually an uncle of Jesus, a great uncle of Jesus, and he played a role in Jesus' life throughout his entire life. And one of the and this comes together from many different sources, and I'll kind of share that with you and your viewers. The first hint that Joseph of Arimathea was not just a rich man who just happened to help out was the fact at the time of Jesus, anybody who was executed was thrown into a common pit after they died. The only exception was if a blood relative came and claimed the body. That was the only way. Joseph of Arimathea claimed the body. So he had a family tie, or he would not have been given the body. So that's the first hint that this man played a more instrumental role. Now, in the research that I've done, which goes back with the old Jewish Talmud and the Harlequin manuscripts and some of the earliest writings by the Eastern Church, there's a lot more about Joseph of Arimathea. And I should really stress that the Eastern Church is older than the European or the Western Church. There, in my book, I have a picture of the first underground church that was in Jordan. It was sort of like in a cave, and that was the first century. So there was nothing like that in Europe or any other place in the world before that. And there, all of those places or all of those sources that I've mentioned all talk about Jesus being taken care of by Joseph of Arimathea after Joseph, the earthly father of Jesus, died. And again, we go back to the customs of that time. A widow and her children would be taken care of by the closest male relative. And in this case, it was Mary's father's youngest brother, and that was Joseph of Arimathea. So that kind of begins to give you an idea of how he played a role in Jesus' life. And I don't want to go on just with a monologue. You can jump in anytime you want here.
No, I, you know, this part of it I'm familiar with, but and I think that you know, from various sources, it certainly has become known that he was a trader, and that he traveled greatly, and that he took Jesus with him.
He had a lot of credentials regarding the travels. He actually, in addition to being like in the Sanhedrin or the Jewish governing council and court, he also worked for the Romans, and he had a title called Nobilius Decurio. He was in charge of the Roman tin mines in southwestern Britain in the Cornwall area. And so in that capacity, he traveled on a regular basis between the Holy Land and southwestern England. And there are legends, and there's actual concrete information that backs it up, that Jesus traveled with him as a young boy. And one of the things was that there is a place where he stopped his ship to get water, and Jesus would help him get water from a well that was at the mouth of the Camel River. To this day, there is a well there that's called the Jesus Well. And you know, obviously it wasn't covered over originally, but then there was this like very small stone structure that was built over this well. And today it is in the middle of the St. Indigat's golf course. And so if you can imagine a fairway, all of a sudden there is a square pit in the middle of this golf course, and it goes down, I'm guessing, I don't really have the dimensions, but to look at the photo that I have in the book, it looks like it goes down, you know, maybe a couple yards. And just the top of this well sticks up into what looks like to be a fairway. So that's just one of the remnants in that part of the world that indicates that Jesus really was there as a boy. Had you heard about that well before?
I've heard about the well. And there, I think one of the things that is so fascinating is that, you know, we hear about him being born, and then we suddenly see him taking up his practice, his preaching and his mission. But you know, for all of those years in between, there is so little known of his life that, you know, everybody accepts a great deal on faith, and yet there's always the desire to know, you know, what happened to him, you know, what was he like as a child? Did he travel? I mean, there are legends that there are, I think, someplace in Tibet, there's a monastery that actually has the proof that he did visit the monastery at one time. So we know that he did travel, but we aren't really sure exactly what he did with those first 33 years. So working with Joseph of Arimathea and traveling around to give him a better perspective of life in other places so that he had a better foundation of wisdom that had been gathered to be able to work into his preaching and into many of his parables.
Well, the only place in the world where there are stone crosses, they're called tunic crosses, and at that time of Jesus, young boys before they went through their bar mitzvah always wore short tunics. Well, they show these tunic crosses in Cornwall, and it shows a young boy still wearing the short tunic with his arms stretched out like in blessing. And I've got four pictures of those. They're very worn, but you can still see them. Another indication of how Jewish that really was in that area is that the old mining places were called Jews' houses, or there's one that's on an old map. It's called the Wheel of Jesus. And a wheel was the name that was used at that time to refer to these tin mines. And I've got photos again in the book that show old mines, not that old, but you can see the wheels that were used, you know, like pulleys to get stuff out of the ground. And so there's still one that's known as the Wheel of Jesus.
So he probably spent a great deal of time there. After the crucifixion, you know, there are rumors. There are some who have the philosophy that Jesus did survive. And I find it fascinating if that was the case, and this is just philosophical. There's no absolute proof, but the rumors are out there, so it's fair game to say that they are, that I'm not sure where Jesus went, but there is a rumor that Joseph of Arimathea went to England, and that's where he died.
Yes, and there's stories about that too. What I've been talking about, though, is during the life of Jesus that he actually traveled.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm referring to my book. It's called Tangible Evidence of Jesus Left Behind for Us to Find. And basically, it comes up, I have all this different information about Jesus that's certainly way beyond what's in the Bible, and it just broadens out the understanding of who Jesus really was. And the Bible simply doesn't give us very much information. And it was so well, I don't know, edited and manipulated and carved up and cut to pieces. And I think there were originally, I couldn't give you the number right now, but I know I have it in my book. It's like 50 Gospels that were essentially tossed aside that were never put in the Bible. I can't say that they're all of great validity, but some of them are. And there's, you know, just an abundance of information if we just, you know, dig and find it. Like I said, the second part of that title is Tangible Evidence of Jesus Left Behind for Us to Find. And more and more of that information is coming out. You had mentioned about him going to Tibet and to the monasteries there. And let's see if I can remember names. The woman who was in, who started the Montessori schools, first in Europe and then in the United States, led a group of, let's say, pilgrims into the monasteries in Tibet. And while they were there, one of the, like a librarian monk, came out with this book, which is not like a book we have. They have more like a rolled up scroll type of book. And he brought it out, and this is a simple quote. He told them, "These books say your Jesus was here." And when you think about the Buddhist teachings and you think about many of the principles that Jesus taught, it does seem like the Buddhist, many of the Buddhist traditions were woven into the lessons that Jesus shared.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that it's a shame, because knowing a little bit a little bit more about his life makes him a more real than, you know, the Bible gives him credit for, because, you know, they really don't let you know where he studied and how he studied and you know, where his wisdom came from, aside from directly from God. But you know, he was human, and he had a human life as well as being a deity, and it's just knowing a little bit more about his life makes him more real in all ways round.
That's
so,
right, and his purpose was to come to Earth and live as a human being and help elevate humankind.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't do that if you're just floating in the sky. You have to get down and and be with the people.
Exactly, and it makes it easier to relate to him and accept his teachings when you learn about, you know, how he spent his youth and the travels that he went into and the hints that he left behind. I mean, that's 2,000 years of, you know, hints that are there if you look hard enough for them. And certainly.
And there's also a lot of indications that after the crucifixion, he did appear to other places in the world. There's a book, it came out in 1963. It's called He Walked the Americas, and it was done by an archaeologist, and her name, I think, was L. Taylor Hansen. And she spent 25 years gathering tribal legends about a mysterious pale god-like healer and teacher who visited tribes throughout the Western Hemisphere, you know, about the time of Jesus or after the crucifixion. And I say after the crucifixion because some of the descriptions from the old legends that predate the arrival of the white man talk about him having marks on his palms.
Wow.
And some of the stories that he shared with them are really very much like the ones that we have heard in parables. He talks about the little lost lamb in the Bible, and at least one of the legends from one of the tribes, he teaches the same lesson with the little lost llama, or the animal.
Yeah.
So he as far as I can see, he was trying to touch as much of the world as he could.
Yeah, and there's also legends that he returned to, I think, India, and they knew him as Asa.
Right.
And so that his message is, you know, has survived beyond the manipulation, those who wrote the Bible. I mean, in all of these other places, there's peace, love, and harmony that he's preaching, as opposed to, you know, creating the foundations for a major religion and stuff like that. He had a message he was giving out, and, you know, the people who wrote the Bible used him as their cornerstone, but kind of went above and beyond the call of duty, so to speak.
That would elevate their motivation.
Yeah.
Not sure that's justified.
No, I'm not saying it is either. But if their purpose was to create a major religion, they did a good job. And I just think that his message was so much more profound. If it had been handled more simply, it might have spread and taken root in more places than it actually did. I think that I sometimes wonder, if you could get him to sit down and talk today, I think he'd be a little horrified at the route that his teachings have taken. But you know, the message is out there, and if you can peel away a lot of the other stuff, the message is pure and simple and still there for anybody to grab onto and hold and live by. So, you know, it's been manipulated, but the truth, the seed of it, is still there. But as a child...
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, as a child, I mean, you hear all these stories about him, and you think, oh my gosh, he was so saintly and constantly preaching wonderful stuff. But he was also a child, and so there had to be an education of sorts that went on that was not, you know, son of God, Savior. It was like, you know, 12, 13, 14-year-old, this is the way we live, and these are the rules we live by. So that the fact that Joseph of Arimathea, took him traveling, and he did see the world, and... I don't know. I see such a similarity in him and the Buddha and you know, some of the other prophet figures that have been in this world. They all seem to have the same flavor, and he's just got blown out of proportion.
I think that scattered through time, there have been evolved, enlightened ones in one form or another who have come. To uplift mankind. And of course the Buddha and Jesus would probably be the most well known, but there were ones before that, and Zoroaster and I don't know, I'm going to go blank on names tonight, but that's just the way it is. But one of the things that I got very strongly in doing the book Tangible Evidence is that was to show that you could live a godly life and still live a fully human life. And the Catholic Church of, not today, but in the past, was very, very male-oriented. They took out things about women in a major way, and so quick to put, like with Mary Magdalene, they put her down as the, possessed evil woman who Jesus saved. In reality, and this comes from many of the ancient writings, she was one of the primary followers of Jesus and most likely understood his teachings better than the fisherman disciples, and was greatly resented by people like Peter because... he just didn't understand why Jesus, you know, acknowledged her and just treated her really like an equal over the men. I mean, he was just very upset by that. But there is, and this is the part that traditional Christians have to open their minds and at least consider. If you consider the idea that he was to live a fully human life, but to live it in a way that presented the highest possible spiritual aspect that could come through a human being, then you have to realize that he led that life fully. And there is increasing evidence that he was married. There was a book that came out in 2012. It was by Dr. James Tabor, who's with the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina. And the book was called The Jesus Discovery. And one part of that, you know, sticks in my head. I don't have to even look at notes. They found a tomb, and during a very short period of time, like 100 years, around the time of Jesus, the way they buried people was they would go out and, create a tomb, like in a hillside. And they were all designed pretty much the same. You would go in through the entranceway, and there would be like a square area that would be like the center court. And then on the other three walls, there would be niches that would go out from there. And the custom at that time was once somebody died, they would put their body in that main room and close it up for a year so that only after a year's time in that kind of climate, only the bones would be left. So then they would reopen the tomb and put the bones in a stone box called an ossuary. And those would then be placed in these niches in the family tombs. Well, they found the family tomb of Jesus. And it was the custom at that time that the most important person was buried in the niche to the right as you came into the tomb. And in this particular tomb, there are three ossuaries. One is Jesus, son of Joseph. One is a familiar form of the name Mary or Miriam, but it has a title with it, which is something like Mar, and it means like Lord, that would be applied to a female. And then there was a third one that said Jude, son of Jesus. So those three were in that same niche in the position of the most important one. And they have done, they did DNA analysis comparing the remnants that were left in there. In these ossuaries, and the female and the one that's labeled as Jesus, there is no family DNA similarity. So it wasn't a mother or a sister or, you know, a cousin or somebody like that. It's somebody who had a total different genetic line, which is very interesting. Also on the woman's or on Mary's ossuary, it uses the familiar name for Mary, almost like a nickname or, you know, showing just a familiar form. That was not Jewish custom. Jewish custom was to be very formal. And then in another niche on another wall, there are other ossuaries with names that are familiar from the New Testament. One of those also had a nickname. And I don't know how Jesus pronounced it, but it was the nickname for his brother Joseph. And it was like, in English, it would be J-O-S-E, Josie. So there's another nickname. It's the way Jesus referred to his brother. And here it again, it is in an ossuary. And this whole thing with the burial goes way beyond that, because there is a rich man's tomb very close to where the family tomb of Jesus is. And it is believed to be that of Joseph of Arimathea, first of all, because he was a known rich man, second, because he was a follower of Jesus, and he also violated Jewish custom because he had a fish etched on his ossuary. Jewish tradition at that time was you had no symbols of animals or, you know, anything, you know, humans or anything of that nature drawn on an ossuary, and yet here was the fish. And the fish had been used by Jesus in teaching about reincarnation. So, Joseph of Arimathea was there from the time that Jesus was a boy until he died.
Now, were they able to carbon date this to that time frame?
As I understand it, yes. Now, I can't quote you data on that off the top of my head. Dr. Tabor is a very, very good researcher, and I probably have already forgotten the name of the book, The Jesus Discovery, or I'll get it straight for you because somebody might want to read it.
It's
called
you know,
The Jesus Discovery by James D. Tabor, T-A-B-O-R.
I think that you know, it's fascinating because there have been a lot of, you know, archaeological shows on that, you know, go into the different aspect of Jesus's life. And I find it fascinating because you kind of can tell when they were made by what they preach, you know, by what they're putting out there as, you know, this is this. And then, you know, that, you know, 10 years later, it's changed. Now, they have the garden tomb that they say is the tomb of Jesus, and yet this would suggest that it's not.
I think the garden tomb was found first, I believe.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure. I don't want to give false information. But this is known as the family tomb of Jesus.
I think that's fantastic. I mean, it doesn't diminish him in any way. I think
No.
We know how
hard it is to be human. So if somebody can be fully human and be as much of the light as he was, then that's to be admired.
Well, yeah, and, you know, when you think about it, the body is just a vehicle.
Correct.
So that it's the spirit that moves on. And so, therefore, it's not a big deal to say he ascended because he did.
Mm-hmm.
And the body was no longer needed, so it was left behind. And it doesn't make him any less by the fact that, you know, he left the body behind and his teachings are still just as valid and just as amazing. I know that with all the research that's going on today, there's so much that they are discovering about the life and times of Jesus and what he did as he grew up and you know, what he worked at before he went on his mission, his journey as far as a spiritual teacher. And it's a very exciting thing. I think it's very sad the Bible doesn't include any of this in it because it would make him so much more real to so many.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that supports the idea that he was married, and there's more than just a couple, Harvard Divinity School professor Karen L. King back in, again, 2012, there was a lot being discovered then, she got one of these old pieces of parchment, which had been like a torn piece from a parchment. And in that dry climate, it survived. And in the book, I show a photo of it and explain the process that they went through to have it, you know, dated and, confirmed in every way that it was real. And there are three lines from that I think are worth mentioning, and they're incomplete because this is a torn segment. And line 4 on this segment says, Jesus said to them, quote, my wife. Line 5, again, it's just a portion of it. She will be able to be my disciple. And line 7, as for me, I dwell with her in order to. And those are just the fragments. But the fragments certainly imply that he was married. Jesus said to them, my wife.
Well, during that time frame, rabbis, and they called him rabbi, rabbis were married.
Absolutely.
So I'm not real sure how this
celibate thing got started. It would not have been considered at all normal. And even though they don't mention the wives of the disciples, I think it comes up kind of offhanded about, and again, I'm not sure, you can't quote me on this one, but it's like Peter refers briefly to his mother-in-law or something, but they were married. You know, they were fishermen
and
that went out and worked. But if they had been a bunch of unmarried men out there, it would have been considered very weird at that time.
I do believe that it was a couple hundred years later that the celibacy came along. It was not something that Jesus even suggested. And there's been a lot of speculation that perhaps the wedding at Cana was his wedding.
I believe that.
It would make sense.
It makes a whole lot of sense. Again, I'm not a good Bible quoter, but there was something about Mary being concerned about the wine.
And
why would she
something.
Be concerned about the wine for anybody else's wedding?
Yeah. No, that made great sense. And I think he becomes a richer person when you discover his humanity too. You know, his mother told him to do something about the wine, and he made wine.
Right.
I mean, you know, yeah, you do that. But I think that Mary Magdalene was definitely an amazing disciple, and she continued his ministry after he died. So in France especially, there's a tremendous amount of reverence shown to her, and legend has it that she did go to France after the crucifixion.
Right, and because of the, they were killing off Jews, and some of the disciples after the death of Jesus, they escaped by boat and ended up in the south of France. And to this day, there is a place called the Three Marys where they landed. And if you have scholars in your audience. There is a gospel called the Gospel of the Beloved Companion, and it appears to be the oldest Christian book in existence and reveals more about the life and teachings of Jesus than the other gospels of the Bible. Now, if somebody doesn't have the time, the money, or the energy or to go out and read all these books, I have deliberately brought out the most important things from this kind of research and put it into this book, Tangible Evidence of Jesus, because people need to know this, and it needs to be put in a form that's easy to read. And I've done it like I do the website. There's lots of photos and lots of visuals to go with it, and I've tried the best I can to put it in a very readable, concise form, simply because I know people, their time is just so valuable.
Well, all of your books are, I've got them all, and I loan them out on a very regular basis because they are, they're an easy read. That doesn't mean that they're simplified. It just means that they're easy to read, and you put the information out there, and you don't confuse it. You make it as simple as possible so that it is a book that you can get through. You can get through most of your books in a day, and come away with a lot of aha moments. And the pictures are amazing. To deviate for a second, Bigfoot Beyond the Footprints. I can't tell you how many people I've loaned it to, and they all come away with they all say they cried. I've loaned it to about five different people, and all of them said I had to sit and cry.
Wow.
Because you gave another spin on it with facts and made them realize that these weren't monsters, that these were, though not people like us, they were people. And
the
real.
American Indians have always regarded them as another clan of people.
Mm-hmm.
It's only invaders of the continent that want to treat them as totally animal-like.
Oh yeah,
that's really sad.
I did want to make sure that I told you that because your book absolutely touched their hearts, and I love all your books, Bigfoot especially, because It just made them. They're not teddy bears by any means. But,
oh no.
But they have a right to their own space, their own time, and their own lives, and we have no right to take any of that from them. So if I had to recommend one, it would be Bigfoot. But then it would be, the evidence, tangible evidence of Jesus left behind for us to find, because it does. What I love about your books is you put enough information out there to make people want to read more and want to go learn more and want to educate themselves more. And I think that's a real gift and a real talent, because it means that you're sending them on a journey of discovery for themselves. And when people discover stuff themselves, it becomes richer and more firmly ingrained within them. So, you know, kudos on all that.
I know that I was not a teacher for very long, but I did teach for like a year and a half, I think. And when you're teaching, you're learning like crazy, because you have to make sure you fully understand it. And, you know, when you have to teach, you have to learn. And so the getting people to get excited about learning is, I think, very important. We can't let our curiosities die.
Oh, gosh, no. And that's the purpose of Nightlight. It's kind of like, let's put stuff out there. Let's make people curious. And you know, maybe even think they're crazy and have to research to prove that we're not. Or, you know, just if we make people think, if we make people start to search and research themselves, then our work here is done, because you've opened up a portal of information and wisdom that no classroom could ever cram down their throats.
Absolutely.
But, you know, I taught for 25 years, and the hardest thing to do was to not give everything out, to make them reach for something and want to find it themselves, because once that happened, then learning takes place.
Right, and think how much we've learned since we got out of school.
Oh, my gosh.
If you have a curiosity.
You know, I had 4 years of college. I have 2 master's degrees, and none of that gave me any of the information that I gather and I use today.
I hear what you're saying. I find it frustrating that some people are so locked into the King James Version of the Bible. They think that God speaks that way, and the reality is that King James, back in the 1600s, wanted to have the Bible in the language of the people of his time. And he didn't even have good language specialists to be doing the interpretations. And so people are limiting themselves if they just go by the Bible, and the King James is not God speaking. And I don't know. They've got to... People can't be afraid to learn more, because God designed us to have curiosities and to learn more and to stretch and become more than we are. He did not intend for us to put ourselves in boxes, and we live in a society where a lot of people have done that.
Oh, sure, and King James had it. Printed in the language of the court so that the common people wouldn't understand what was happening. And you know, King James, I mean, if you really want to really make yourself a tad sick, then, you know, look into King James. He was a dirty old man. And happily, he was more than a dirty old man. But happily, he didn't actually write the Bible. He commissioned it.
That's correct.
So that he didn't have a great deal of influence on any of it, I hope. But, you know, there are, speaking of the Bible, there is a gospel according to Mary and a gospel according to Thomas, and I believe Thomas was in one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, too.
I think you're correct.
So that you know, there are these gospels out there that probably had validity to be put into the Bible, but weren't. And, you know, the Catholic Church now kind of just says, oh, don't pay attention to them. But you know, especially Thomas had a lot of quotations that Jesus had made that didn't make it into the final edition of the Bible when they put it together. The people that I have family members who say that the Bible is inspired writing, and when God was done, he decided he wasn't going to write anymore, and he moved on. And much as I love my family members, I have thought, oh, come on, I'll give you inspired writing, but, you know, you can't tell me that, you know, God is off in another universe and no one else has ever been inspired, because that's just not true.
Right.
So that there are a lot of these outside the Bible books, texts, you know, material that are just as valid and just as rich in wisdom. And to restrict yourself to just a book that was put together by, you know, Helena and Constantine and Eusebius doesn't make sense.
Right.
I mean, if Jesus was preaching his wisdom to everybody, then there must have been a couple of, you know, texts that should have been in the Bible that weren't, that are worth reading and worth looking into.
Since you're bringing up family, I will bring up my own dad, and he must have been much smarter than he's no longer living, but he had to have been had more brains than I have, because he actually could read Hebrew and Greek. And when he went to the Oberlin Graduate School of Theology and later blended with Vanderbilt, and he was part of the team that did the translation for the Revised Standard Version of the Bible, he's the first one that really got me thinking about what the words really mean. And one of the things that stuck in my head since childhood was he pointed out that the word virgin, you know, which means one thing in our society today, but he said back then the original word simply meant a young woman. There was no indication of chastity or no chastity. And as a very young person, that just stuck in my head. And so I began to realize how important the translations can be, and how just the change of a word just a little bit can change the context of something totally.
Well, I, you know, since you're going this direction, a good reference book for anybody who's really looking into stuff is Strong's Concordance, because what they did is they went through the Bible and they took every word back to its original language it was written in and what it meant during that time. And in the Bible, when they speak of the heavens, you know, and such, they're not talking about, you know, palaces in the clouds. They're talking about the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Because the original meaning for heavens was sky, because it was above. So that puts a whole other,
different
twin
on it.
Yeah. And, well, yeah. And the first words, you know, in the beginning, God made the heaven and earth. That's not what it originally translates to. It originally translates to, in the beginning, the gods, plural, made the heavens and the earth, which makes you think a little bit too. So, and I'm not saying don't pay attention to your Bible, because it's a wonderful collection, but it's just a collection. There's a lot more out there too. You can add to the collection and enrich the wisdom that you have to, you know, blend into your own life and your own way of dealing with situations that confront you. Don't
Absolutely.
Restrict yourself to just that. I mean, I'm not trashing the Bible. I'm just saying there were more applicants to the book that made it in. And,
well,
and
in my book, I do list, and I should have maybe counted them before you and I started to talk, but there must be 50 Gospels that weren't included, and I list them by name. You know, and you can take any of those and start to explore them. So if you want to use this as a jumping-off block, that this book certainly will do that. I actually start the book off with descriptions of Jesus. There is I'm sure he's not living anymore, but there was an archaeologist who, Raymond Capp, C-A-P-T, and he had credentials both in Scotland and the United States. He did extensive research. Much of it had to do with Jesus, and he found two letters. One was written by Pontius Pilate to Tiberius Caesar, And then there was another Roman who I really know nothing about him, but he also wrote a letter to Caesar. And they were just, both of them in one way or another, were describing how Jesus looked. Now, I remember seeing, everybody's locked into Jesus must have looked like everybody else around him. And according to these letters, he didn't. Let's see. It talks about him. All right, here's a sentence. What a contrast between him and his bearers with their black beards and tawny complexions. And they referred to him as having golden-colored hair and a beard, that was similar. The descriptions among the ancient legends in the Western Hemisphere also describe him that way. They describe him as having light eyes. One of them described his eyes as being like changeable, like the ocean or like the sea. So he was of a lighter complexion. Now, this, I would have to go back and do my own, you know, research to confirm this. But somewhere or another, I read that the mother of Mary was originally from the British Isles. So that could explain some of the lighter features.
Exactly. And there are, I don't know what book I was reading it in, but when they were talking about the Holy Grail, they said sometimes there were three, and it wasn't, one was a cup, one was a plate, one was a book. And there was another one that was a carving of the head of Jesus, a bust of him. And, you know, the only thing that we refer back to are, you know, the Renaissance pictures of what he appeared to be. You know, you don't know what really he looked like. And yet it's interesting because every culture that describes Jesus, they describe Jesus as one of their culture or you know, what they look like. So there are black Jesuses and there are Indian Jesuses.
Right.
And I think it's fascinating in that it does suggest that his words and his philosophies and his teachings translate into whatever society he has to be in, so that he was always one of them. He wasn't a stranger.
Correct. But even among, he visited apparently many, many tribes throughout the Western Hemisphere after the crucifixion. And they were all different, but they all described him as being more of the lighter features. And they were in a world where nobody had features like that.
Well, having a mother, you know, a grandmother who was from Great Britain would certainly do it.
That certainly would.
And so, you know, there are some that say that you know, the ones that wore the beards were was it the Essenes or what, that commonly they didn't have the beards. So that he may easily have been clean shaven as well.
No, that I don't know about.
Has to do with the hair being cut and stuff like that. I think they're the Nazarene. I think
there's the Nazarenes and there's the Nazarites. The Nazarites, if I have this correct, are the ones that are the more stringent in their belief. They wouldn't cut their beards. They had their whole code of living was much more strict. Just to be a Nazarene did not imply that you had all these strict followings. I don't know if I'm accurate saying. That's what I know as of this moment.
Okay, so I've read it somewhere, and I've read so much lately, I can't tell you where it was. But it had to do with the fact that sometimes for a year they did things like fasting and not cutting their hair and not shaving, but it was only for a year. And then after that year's time, whether they were in mourning for something or whether they were going through some sort of cleansing for some sort of rite, but that traditionally they didn't have the long hair and the beards. So, but you know, we're going back 2,000 years, and there's no knowing. mm-hmm. what the traditions were at the time. We just are assuming from the pictures that we've seen and the stained glass windows that we've seen that that's what Jesus looked like. And he probably didn't look anything like he's been depicted, which is kind of cool.
That's a real good possibility.
But you
that's,
know,
that's probably should be the least of our concern. It's the other parts that we've been talking about that are significant.
I mean, his message has certainly come through, and his teachings have come through, and they are far more simple than you know sometimes the churches make out. But you know, basically, he taught the golden rule, and kindness and compassion and forgiveness. And, you know, you incorporate those into your life and you have a richer life. You may not have a lot of money, but you'll have a richer life for sure. and I think
those that are filthy rich, I don't much care for what I'm seeing them doing in our present society right now.
Well, you know, I've often thought, you know, it would be great to win $1 million, but then I realized if I had $1 million, I'd spend the rest of my life trying to protect it from people taking it from me. It's easier to not have it.
Now you don't have to worry. You don't have to worry about that, right?
No, not at all. So not being rich is really
freeing. It gives you you freedom.
It is. It's
unless
safer.
Unless you're so dirt poor that you have to worry about everything, and you don't want to be there either.
No, I'm not there, but middle ground is a real good place to be. And I think that his teachings are still phenomenal, and that if you go to his pure teachings, then you can't go wrong. You truly can't. And life has become so complicated, and religious churches tend to make it more complicated. And I'm not against churches. I'm against people feeling that there is something between them and God, because
right.
there's not.
We all have our own telephone line to God. We do
mm-hmm.
not have to go through somebody else. And the church, in trying to keep its power and control, made humans feel like they had to go through the priest to get to God, or go through Mary to get to God. And
mm-hmm.
We're all children of God. We all can connect with him.
Absolutely. And Jesus was a remarkable person, a remarkable ambassador for a greater
right.
truth.
Right.
And,
good witness. Nicely said.
He did a good job. We only have a couple minutes left. I do want to thank you so much again for sharing your wisdom with us and remind people that Skyships Over Cashiers is something you must check out. If you have any curiosity at all about anything, check it out, because the archives are there for the last 10 or 12 years as well, so that you can see that this lady has been a very busy lady in her spare time. And I don't know when you had the time to do all this, but my theory
but anyhow,
is if, you're doing
if, what... if people want to learn about any of the books that we've mentioned, if you go to skyshipsovercashiers.com, on the home page, there is a heading on the left that says Editor's Corner. Click on
uh-huh.
that, scroll way down to the bottom, and there'll be information about the books.
Oh, cool. They're all phenomenal. They're worth a read. They're worth having in your library and on your coffee table for people to pick up. And I buy two of each because I seem to be lending them out more than anything else, and every now and then they don't come back. But I'm very confident they find another good home. Mary, again, I thank you so much. Is there some place you're going to be talking or something you're going to be doing that you want to get out there?
I'm just doing local stuff right now and nothing that anybody on a national level wants to hear. So
we'll just send them to Skyships Over Cashiers, because you will be blown away by the way she presents her material. It makes it so simple to see and understand, and it will make you want to learn more and delve in more, and the archives are there for you to do that too. So,
and the books are all available through Amazon. Everybody knows about Amazon.
Everybody does, and they're well worth having. So thank you again, and we look forward to talking to you next month sometime, if your time allows.
We get into the
And so we look forward to talking to you and being with you and sharing with you again. Thanks, everybody, for being with us. Good night now.